Wildlife Trade Monitoring Group says this has been a disastrous year for elephants, possibly the worst since sales of ivory were banned in 1989 to save elephants from extinction. The Traffic Network says the number of elephant tusks seized this year represents 2,500 dead animals. And Traffic says it shows that Asian organized crime syndicates are increasingly involved in illegal ivory trade. A Traffic spokesman says he fears criminals may now have the upper hand in the contest over whether rare and endangered animals will be saved. Some of the elephant tusks seized come from older stockpiles, so experts say it's not clear how many animals have been killed recently in Africa. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Focus Features with Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy from author John Le Carré, starring Gary Oldman, Colin Firth, and Tom Hardy, in select theaters now.
Programs on WILL are made possible by Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
When you donate appreciated stock you've held for more than a year instead of selling it, you can save tax two ways. First, you avoid capital gains tax on the increase in value of your stock. Second, you receive a deduction for the full fair market value of the stock on the date you make the gift. I'm Donda Beard, and you can call me at WILL for more information about giving stock. Thanks for your support.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind that we will not be taking calls. In the first hour of the program today, we'll be exploring some of the history of the American Civil War and looking at some aspects of the war that I think probably a lot of Americans aren't familiar with. More than 50,000 British citizens fought in the American Civil War. Perhaps more important to the outcome of the war, though, was what the nation of Britain and its government chose not to do, in spite of its reliance on the South and its cotton and its rejection of slavery. The British government did not take sides in this conflict. In this hour, we'll be talking with historian Amanda Foreman. She is the author of a newly published book that is newly published here in the United States, which is titled A World on Fire. The subtitle is Britain's Crucial Role in the American Civil War, and Random House is the publisher. And the book takes a look at the ways in which Britain tried to steer a course between support for the North and its stand against slavery and support for the South, which portrayed itself around the world as a small nation fighting bravely for independence, something that certainly resonated with a lot of people in Britain. Amanda Foreman is a visiting research fellow at Queen Mary University of London. She has lived and studied on both sides of the Atlantic. She was an undergraduate at Sarah Lawrence College with master's and doctorate degrees in history from Oxford, and she now makes her home in the United States. She lives in New York. She's joining us this morning by telephone. And Amanda Foreman, hello.
Hello, David.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. It's a great story, and I do think that this will, I hope, it will perhaps add some to what it is here we in the United States know and think about this great conflict that was so important to our history. And I think also it's worth noting that you're, I think, uniquely positioned to write about this as you had an American dad and a British mom and apparently a long-standing interest in American history of this period.
Well, that's right. I mean, when I started A World on Fire, a lot of people, especially in England, said to me, this is crazy. Surely you're just being a tourist now. You've taken the wrong elevator and turned up in the Civil War. And the reason they said that is because my first book was called The Duchess, and that became an international bestseller, and turned into the movie The Duchess, starring Keira Knightley and Ralph Fiennes. And that book is a biography of an 18th century duchess called Georgiana, Duchess of Devonshire, and she was a very famous, in England that is, very, very famous political hostess. Hmm. So people thought, wow, what's an 18th century historian doing going into 19th century history and 19th century Anglo-American history? And the answer is that actually I went from Sarah Lawrence in New York to Oxford to study attitudes to race and colour in 18th century Britain, and that had come out of my long-standing interest in race and slavery in America. And so I had wanted to get to the kind of the crux of the matter by going to England and figuring out what had been the case in the 18th century in order to understand what had happened later in the 19th century.
Yeah.
And it was while I was just reading around the subject that I discovered the Duchess, and I got sidetracked. But I always knew I wanted to get back to slavery, the Civil War, and Britain and America together.
Yeah. You know, it's a fascinating story. It's really quite complicated. And when you look at the British side and the government and how it thought about the United States and what and why it might choose to support either the North or the South, there are all sorts of reasons why it would have done one or another. And I don't want to overly reduce things too much here at the beginning, but it does seem to be the case that if you ask the question, well, what was the most significant thing that Britain did? One might say that the most significant thing that Britain did was to do nothing. Does it really come down to that?
Well, Professor James McPherson, the great Professor James McPherson, who I think is acknowledged as, you know, I guess, the doyen of Civil War history today. He put it this way. He said that sometimes the not doing something is so vital that it is the crux of the story.
Mm.
He put it this way. He said, when in one of Sherlock Holmes' most famous story, he asks, why did the dog not bark in the night? And once you answer that question, you solve the mystery. And so in England, although you're saying, well, why did England not come down hard on the side of the North or the South, i.e., why is inaction not what's so important about that? The truth is that at that point, Britain was the most powerful nation in the world. And if Britain had indeed come down on one side or the other, it would have ended the war, because if it had come down on the side of the North, it would have said to the South, there is no way that the world, that is us, we are going to recognize your independence. That means you will not be able to get credit, you will not be able to sell your wares, you'll not be able to take your ships to our ports, we will not respect your ambassadors or your laws. In other words, you will be dead in the water. And to know why that is so important, if you look at today, for example, and what's going on in Libya, the fact that the Libyan rebels have not had their existence, their provisional government recognized, means internationally, means that old Libya still stands.
Well, would it also be true, though, that maybe one might argue that the conflict was prolonged because people in the South continued to believe that Britain might come in on their side, that the answer to that question was not quite so clear cut?
I would go even further than that. It wasn't simply that hope burned alive in the hearts of Southerners, but that actually British neutrality, and there is a reason why Britain became neutral, which we'll go into later,
mm-hmm.
but British neutrality, which is an internationally recognized state of being, when a country declares neutrality in a war, it actually allows the belligerents of who are fighting that particular war a kind of quasi-legal status and a legal ability to do certain things. It allowed the South to legally come to Britain and buy arms. And it could do that above board. And the South did that. The South had no factories. It had no way of manufacturing its own guns and arms. But by being able to go to Britain, it bought thousands and thousands and thousands of British rifles, uniforms, medicines, blankets, ammunition, you name it. And that was incredibly important. I mean, it was vital for the South to be able to get its arms from somewhere, and it imported them from Britain.
One thing that here maybe we might start to, as we try to unpack a little bit about how the British looked at the war and how that influenced what they did. If you ask the question, well, as governments look around the world, what is it they're interested in? I think that it is the case that in most of the time, what governments are interested in is the status quo. They don't like things to change. So you would say, well, at the outset, that the British, maybe what they would have been interested in the United States would have been stability. So from that perspective, maybe they'd say, well, we don't really want to see America split in two. On the other hand, they might also have looked on the United States as a rival. So they might have thought, well, maybe better two weaker countries than one stronger one. So that would really, you could make the argument one way or another just from that perspective, that either going either way, trying to influence the outcome or not, would have been the way to go. How did the British government think about the question of one America or two?
Well, there's a popular myth in this country that, you know, Britain wanted the South to win because it really wanted to see, as you say, one nation divided into two weaker nations. Mm-hmm. But actually, that was a real fear for the British. What you have to remember is that in the 19th century, in the mid-19th century, there was a great deal of Anglophobia in the United States. It was any politician who wanted to be popular just had to say, I hate old Mother England, let's sock it to her. And, you know, amazingly, that would win him votes. I mean, not surprisingly in some ways, because there were over a million Irish immigrants living in America who'd been driven over here by the famine, the Great Famine in Ireland and other places, and they were furious with Britain's poor response to the famine, and there was a long legacy of hatred between the Irish and the English. So there were lots of internal historical reasons why there was this huge Anglophobia, even before you add in the American Revolution and the War of 1812 between Britain and the U.S. So Britain really feared what America might do if Britain ever found itself in a pickle. So, for example, say Britain was fighting a war against Russia, which had just happened in 1856 when France and Britain fought the Crimean War against Russia. Now, during the Crimean War, America supported Russia. It did not support Britain. And, in fact, secretly allowed its U.S. citizens to volunteer for the Russian army, to send arms to Russia, and even supplied a warship to Russia. So the Brits had a pretty fair idea what America might do if Britain was in trouble. And their reasoning was, my goodness, say the U.S. divides into two, or even three with a Northwestern Confederacy, that would mean that we would never be able to be completely sure that we could have America on side. Because you can guarantee if, say, the North supported Britain in some future conflict in Europe, the South wouldn't. You would never get all two or three sides to agree on any one thing. So they wanted America to stay united, or at least that way they could be sure in their, you know, in their own game of international diplomacy of things.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Amanda Foreman, and we are talking about her new book, A World on Fire. It is about the role that Britain played in the American Civil War. It's recently been published here in the United States. Random House is the publisher, and it's out now if you want to take a look at it. And questions are welcome as well. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And you can also send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. It's certainly one of the big issues here, maybe it was the biggest in influencing how British people thought about this and thought about the United States was slavery. And so, again, that would argue because the British had abolished slavery, and there was a very strong public opinion against slavery in Britain. So on the one hand, you would say, well, that would probably argue for their supporting the North. And at the same time, though, there seemed to be a much stronger sort of cultural identification between Britain and the South, and layered on top of that was this idea that there was some sympathy for the idea that what the Southerners were struggling for was independence, and all of that gets all mixed up together. And no doubt pulls the British in completely different directions.
I mean, that's right. The one thing you can say with certainty is that there was no unanimity in Britain about the war ever, and you could always find opposition views. Even when there was a majority thinking one way, there was always a very loud minority. The tragedy of the Civil War is at the very, very beginning, as you mentioned just now, Britain's attitude towards slavery and its own stance on anti-slavery, and it had obviously abolished slavery 30 years earlier throughout the entire British Empire, meant that it was already inclined to support the North. As you say, it wasn't, you know, it doesn't normally like the status quo being disturbed. So, you know, it wasn't instinctively sympathetic with the South for that reason. And the South was a slaveholding entity and wanted to become a slaveholding nation. So Britain and the British government in particular was inclined to support the North. Unfortunately, and here is the tragedy, at the beginning of the war, the Secretary of State was William Henry Seward. And Seward believed wrongly, and later came to regret this bitterly, that there was strong Union sentiment in the South, and all he needed to do was to find a way to galvanize that, and there would be no war. So his suggestion to Lincoln and to the cabinet was, let's start a foreign war. Let's create a kind of international conflict that will reunite the North and the South together. And there is no greater common enemy in the North and the South than Britain. So let's start a war, or go towards making steps to starting a war with Britain, and, you know, all thoughts of civil war will die down. And even though Lincoln didn't agree with this, Seward went ahead with it anyway. And his statements, his actions, the way he went just almost as far as trying to expel the British ambassador, all kinds of, you know, obvious taunts and insults at Britain, at the British government, designed to make it react by declaring war or, you know, taunting or insulting the U.S. back. All that served to do was to turn Britain, which was willing and wanted to come in on the side of the North, so it turned a willing ally into a hostile neutral.
Yeah, that's really fascinating here, the way that the United States, by its belligerency, and maybe not just the United States government, but Seward was certainly had a lot to do with it, by the belligerency against Britain, really annoyed, irritated the British government, so that made them less inclined to support the North. At the same time, though, I think the British were concerned about the possibility they would rather probably not have to go to war with the United States. The United States did have this card to play that was the potential invasion of Canada. So then perhaps for that reason, that would be another reason that the British would have not coming in on the side of the South, because they really would rather probably not have the United States declare war on them because of their support for the South.
Sure. I mean, yeah. Nobody wants to start a war. I mean, you know, and they had just had the Crimean War only 5 years earlier. And, yeah, I mean, so, yes, there's never really one reason. There's always a big reason and then lots of supporting reasons that bolster up the first reason. So, sure. Now, but if you look at the South, what they believed, turns out wrongly, of course, was that cotton is king, and that all they needed to do was to waive the threat of blackmail and say, we will turn off the spigot of cotton, your cotton mills will go dry, your 500,000 textile workers will be thrown out of a job. And the fact that one in five Englishmen owes his livelihood in some way to the textile industry, will one in five Englishmen, therefore, will find their livelihoods damaged or destroyed by us unless you recognize independence. I mean, an analogy would be the oil crisis created by OPEC in the 1970s, which believed that all they needed to do was to turn off the spigot of oil and the Western governments would fall to their knees and do anything that they wanted.
Yeah. It's interesting, too, that in Britain, apparently even those people who supported the South were anti-slavery, and that there were people who thought, really make the argument that after the war was over and the South had won, that Britain could somehow persuade the South to abolish slavery.
Yes, everyone believed that. That is the one unanimous belief that they all had. And it comes from, first of all, it comes from tremendous ignorance that, you know, the British did not understand the South, didn't truly understand the causes of the Civil War, and certainly didn't understand the American political system or how slavery had evolved, why it was popular in the South, not in the North. I mean, they thought they got it, but they didn't really understand it. And most Brits don't really understand how American politics works today, and that's for the benefit of the internet and everything else. So when Southern propagandists came over and were paid to write in newspapers and tell politicians and give speeches to say, you know, this war is all about independence. It's all about the right to self-determination. And you can't ask the South to review its slavery stance now when it's fighting for survival, but we can assure you that once the war is terminated, then the South can, you know, review what's going on. And obviously, it wants to be just like you, you British gentlemen, you who abolished slavery 30 years ago, because we're all white and we're all gentlemen here and we all have these great estates. Trust us. And it was a very seductive, although entirely wrong, argument. Mm.
Late in the war, I think actually Jefferson Davis and the Confederacy tried to play that card and actually made a proposal to the British government saying, okay, if you will come in on our side and support us, then once the war is over, we will abolish slavery.
Yes, but by that time, it was 2 weeks before, well, the British received the that letter literally 2 weeks before the war ended. And it was something that Davis decided upon literally with his back against the wall, and the South was dying. It was crumbling on its feet. There were only several weeks left, and he and the Confederate Congress agreed to this simply because there was nothing left. This was the very, very, very last, to them, nuclear bomb in their arsenal. So they tried it, and it was too late.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation, someone in Urbana. By the way, anybody who's listening, if you'd like to call in with a question, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller on our line number one. Hello.
Good morning. A fascinating subject. Would the author please tell us some particulars, such as were there Southern and Northern supporters of the South and supporters of the North in the British Parliament, and who were they, and also the name of the British Prime Minister and reigning monarch at the time?
Oh, sure, of course, and I apologize for not making all this clear. So the reigning monarch is Queen Victoria and her husband, Prince Albert. At this point, she is middle-aged and has been on the throne for over 30 years. And curiously, both she and Prince Albert are pro-North. They are instinctively pro-North because they are anti-slavery. So even though the rest of the country can be confused about it, they are not. Prince Albert is so pro-North that, in fact, when he died tragically 6 months into the war, his last act, as literally he lay dying on his bed from cholera, was to change a letter written by the British government to Washington, which he thought was too aggressive and was guaranteed to start a war between the U.S. and Britain over something called the Trent Affair, which involved two Confederate ambassadors being taken off a British mail boat by a U.S. naval captain. And to give you the equivalent of that, that would be the same as a U.S. airline flight being forced to land by two Iranian fighter jets and two Iranian dissidents being taken off that flight and taken back to Iran, and then the American Airlines flight allowed to carry on to wherever it was going. So, you know, it's a very provocative thing to do. But Prince Albert realized that the British response was inflammatory and guaranteed to create a war, and so he changed the letter and enabled Washington to save face and return the two Confederate ambassadors. So that's Queen Victoria and Prince Albert. In Parliament, there was a very, very strong Confederate lobby of this is a group of MPs who were pro-South, and they include several shipping magnates, a man called William Laird, another man called William Shaw Lindsay, another MP called John Roebuck. And then, but on the other side, there was an equally strong pro-Northern lobby, and they were led by Richard Cobden and John Bright, John Foster and others. And they squared up against each other, but what's interesting is that they came from both sides of the House, i.e. the lobbies themselves were made up of a mixture of MPs both on the left and the right wing of British politics. So it was an argument that cut across party lines.
And who was the Prime Minister?
Lord Palmerston.
And how, what, did he favor North or South?
Well, be honest, Lord Palmerston really disliked Americans and thought that the whole country was a bunch of hypocrites. And the reason he felt that was that by then he was an old man in his 80s, and he had been in politics from before the War of 1812. He was actually the Undersecretary of War in 1812. So this is a guy who'd seen everything. He was alive during the French Revolution.
Wow.
And exactly. So, and his whole life had been dedicated to two things. One was chasing women, and the other was fighting slavery. And but his womanizing was so notorious, he was known as Lord Cupid. Anyway, but he'd always been dedicated to fighting slavery, and the one country that had consistently stymied his efforts had been the United States. And the one thing that Palmerston had almost succeeded in doing, and it had taken half a century to do, was putting together an alliance to stop the slave trade. And every single country had signed up to an agreement which would allow the British Navy to search any suspected slave trading ship. The one country that refused to sign up was the United States, which meant that the entire slave trade, and this is in 1860, yes. 1861, was being conducted by ships flying American flags.
Thank you so much.
All right. Well, thank you. And again, other questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have talked here about the fact that the official policy of the British government was neutrality in this conflict. At the same time, you mentioned earlier that the British were selling war material to the Confederates, and in fact, the British built ships for the Confederacy. How did they square their supposed neutrality with the fact that they were supplying weapons and ships to the South?
Well, Britain was supplying weapons to both sides, and that's just the way it goes. I mean, anybody could come to Britain, and any agent, any arms dealer could come to Britain, North or South, and openly buy arms. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Britain not only didn't find that a problem, it was rather thrilled because its economy actually grew during the Civil War, even though there was this massive cotton famine and no cotton was being received in Britain from the South, which meant that those textile mills and those 1 in 5 Englishmen indeed saw their livelihood suffer. But because the war itself demanded British guns, British woolens, you know, all kinds of other manufactured goods, actually, Britain did rather well out of the war. So, no, they didn't. To be honest, nobody's worried twice about that.
So that was, as far as they were concerned, that was just a commercial transaction, and that didn't have anything to do with foreign policy or, you know, who they wanted to win. It was just it was about business.
Exactly. But the Confederate ships that were built is something entirely different. When Britain declared neutrality, the flip side of that coin is that the neutrality laws declared that although anybody could buy guns, nobody was allowed to build warships. Mm. Neither side was allowed to build anything like a warship in British ports. So what the Confederates did was that they used third parties. They used sympathizers who would front the contracts, and then these ships would be secretly built in Liverpool. And these raiders, as they were called, were sent out to prey on northern commerce. And the most notorious of them is called the CSS Alabama, which sunk over 64 northern merchant ships and caused millions of dollars worth of damage. And actually, these Confederate raiders destroyed the North's merchant marine because no civilian merchant ship belonging to North could get insurance. It became too expensive. And so the North was absolutely furious with Britain for allowing these ships to get built and set sail. But it became too difficult. It was almost impossible for several reasons for the Brits, for the government, to stop this. First of all, these ships were being built secretly. So you had to find them, you had to locate them. Then you had to determine what laws were being broken. And it was very difficult. The South was very clever. These front men own the ships. They own the ships fair and square. You can't stop somebody building a ship that looks like a warship, that has holes cut out for cannons, but no actual cannons on them. So it looks suspicious, but it's not actually a warship. Then these raiders would leave Britain, and they would sail into neutral waters, and there all the guns and the arms and all the bits that make a warship would be loaded on and fixed, and then they'd sail away. So it was a very, very clever thing that the Confederates did, and the Brits just didn't know quite what to do and bungled the whole thing. So after the war, the U.S. government sued Britain and demanded compensation for Britain's failure to work harder to find a way to stop these Confederate raiders being built and escape.
In this hour of Focus, our guest is Amanda Foreman. We're talking about her book, A World on Fire, Britain's Crucial Role in the American Civil War. It's published by Random House. And we have a caller here who's been patient. We'll get to them on our line one right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd like to ask Ms. Foreman why the Confederacy thought that the British Isles would sponsor or a country that was basing their would sponsor a country that based their economy on slavery when the British Isles freed all their slaves in 1833. In 1833.
Why did the Southerners think that the British would support them, given the fact that slavery was so important?
Well, that's a very good question, and they were so worried that Britain wouldn't support them that's why at the beginning of the war they tried to use blackmail, and because they felt that Britain instinctively wouldn't support them because of the slavery issue. And so they tried blackmail first and stopped cotton going across to Britain. And when that didn't work, they tried a new tactic. And that tactic was based on something that unfortunately came out of the North's policy. As you remember, President Lincoln did not announce his Emancipation Proclamation until halfway through the war. And although there are sound and very immovable reasons why Lincoln couldn't do that, he couldn't go any faster, couldn't bring the border states on board, the North itself was divided over whether the war was about Union or about slavery, so he could not move any faster. But that meant that the world that was watching the war took Lincoln at face value. And it was up to the Secretary of State, William Henry Seward, to tell the world that even though Lincoln isn't actively talking about slavery, actually the war is about slavery. And he never bothered to do that. He allowed there to become a huge gap, as it were, a gap in the market, where anybody could step in, any propagandist could step in Europe and in Britain, to say, well, look, you see, the North are hypocrites. They're only fighting for empire. They just want to keep America whole. That doesn't. There's nothing exciting about that. Whereas look at the South. The South is fighting for freedom, for the right to self-determination. So you should support the South because it wants to be free. And very few people in England said, "Well, hang on a sec. The South is fighting for the freedom to take away the freedom from others. What's so great about that?"
Right? Okay, and I have a question about Charles Francis Adams, our ambassador to Great Britain at the time, the Laird Rams. Could you speak to that?
Yes, so Charles Francis Adams was the American ambassador in the Court of St. James in England at the time. He'd been sent over at the beginning of the war in 1861. And the Laird Rams were these two extremely powerful ironclad warships that were being built at a British company, Laird Brothers, by the Confederate Secret Service and the Confederate Navy under a man called James Bullock. And everyone knew about these rams. They were known to be extremely dangerous and might possibly have a tremendous effect on the war. No one quite knew how big an effect, but you build two enormous warships, it's obviously going to do something. And Charles Francis Adams wanted Britain to stop these rams. And not unnaturally, the government agreed with him. They felt that this would be an embarrassment to the British legal system if these two not-so-secret Laird Rams were allowed to leave British shores. And they couldn't see a way to do it, though, because legally the South didn't own these Laird Rams. They were just warlike ships. And finally, the British government issued an order stopping them from sailing, didn't give the reason why. And then when the Laird brothers challenged that ruling, the British government just offered to buy the Rams. So that's how they stopped the Laird Rams from leaving Britain, is they just bribed the British company that was building them to sell them the Rams rather than letting the South have it. I mean, it was a real admission of defeat. But Adams, you know, Adams could genuinely feel quite pleased with himself that he'd been agitating all the way along and had never given up this fight. Where Adams slightly overstepped his mark was that he believed that he was the one who stopped the Laird Rams and then told everyone that, which earned him a lot of enemies, since it's never one person, it's a lot of people. And, you know, he then made the British government look weak, whereas, in fact, it had been on his side the whole time, and so they were rather annoyed with him.
I want to thank the caller, and I have somebody here I want to get into in just a moment. But if, for a second here, I want to come back to the cotton issue, as we have discussed, you know, as Britain was thinking about why would they get in on into the war on one side or another. One reason for supporting the South was to make sure that they had continued access to Southern cotton, which was extremely important for the textile industry in Britain, and it meant the jobs of a lot of people. And when the cotton was not available because of the war, a lot of people actually in Britain lost their jobs. Amazingly enough, though, British cotton workers were very strong opponents of the Confederacy and of slavery, even though what was going on really cost a lot of people their jobs.
That's right, and it's really incredible because Southern propagandists sent in professional agitators who tried to stir up riots and mass meetings in these cotton towns that were so deprived and failed to do so. I mean, there were meetings, but there were never any riots. And if you look at right now, there are mass riots going on in Britain. And we know that there's just in each of these cities where there are riots, there are professional agitators using Twitter and Facebook and instant messaging to stir up trouble. So, I mean, you know, these things go on all the time in every era. And it just goes to show how principled the cotton workers were. They said, their leaders said, look, we are cotton workers. We own the fruit of our labor. We, more than anyone else, understand what it means to be free to work and to have the freedom to own what you produce. And therefore, they were absolutely adamant that they were not going to support a slave state.
Well, we're coming down to about our last 10-12 minutes in this hour of Focus, talking with Amanda Foreman about her book, A World on Fire, that looks at Britain's role in the American Civil War. We have some other callers, and we'll go right on to Clay City, Illinois, for another line number two. Hello.
Yes, I was just curious about Wilberforce in England stopped slavery. What was the institution of slavery right like in England as compared to the institution of slavery in the United States? And were the British aware of the brutality and how ruthless the slave owners were in the South? That's my question.
That's a very good question. There was no slavery per se in the United Kingdom. That is England, Scotland, Wales, and Ireland. There had been a very famous lawsuit in the 1770s, which decreed that as soon as a human being set foot on British soil, that human being, man or woman, was free. But throughout the British Empire and basically in the Caribbean, there were slaves. There were slaves on the sugar plantations and the plantations that turned sugar into rum in places in Jamaica, and they were notorious. They were brutal, terrible, notorious places. And the way the British abolished slavery was that they paid compensation. It was compensated emancipation. They basically bought the freedom of every single one of those slaves on those Caribbean islands. So So that's how Britain dealt with slavery. And the book, Uncle Tom's Cabin, sold 1 million copies when it was published in England, compared to 300,000 copies in the U.S. when it was published in the 1850s.
Thank you for your response.
You're welcome. Thank you. And let's go on to another caller. Effingham, I believe, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. I think what I'm about to ask is relevant to the conversation. I know I go to the left, but the whole agenda of capitalist organization and the system it produced, which is interlaced with labor, whether that labor was free or slave, it has turned into, in the Western world, now you use the term freedom. Well, freedom then lets you go to the marketplace where you can get a job or maybe you can't. And that evolves then into all the things that are being discussed in these times. But I have to refer to Karl Marx and his writings and the manifesto and all the things that came from that. And my question, I guess, is, does your guest see all the references, all the connections between slave labor and wage slavery? Thank you.
Well, interesting enough, Karl Marx wrote extensively on the Civil War. He, one of his journalistic gigs, as it were, one of his journalistic appointments as money spinners during the early 1860s was as a journalist for a U.S. newspaper. And he supported the North. He definitely felt that no matter how bad the kind of wage slavery that existed in some of the North's textile mills in places like Massachusetts, and we know that the conditions in those places were pretty awful, no matter how bad they were, it was peanuts compared to the existence of slavery in the South.
Well, we have talked about the importance of the economic relationship between the South and Britain, and about how that would be a factor in how the British thought about the conflict. But certainly there were economic ties between Britain and the North. Can you talk about that and how that factors into the equation?
Sure, there were great economic ties between Britain and the North. I mean, the banking system of the North was very heavily tied in with Britain. And you can certainly see how the policy statements of the Secretary of State, William Henry Seward, would change whenever Northern bankers tried to sell their U.S. bonds to and Treasury bonds abroad, and in particular to British banks. At that point, the kind of anti-British rhetoric would go down, and the bonds would get sold, and then once they were sold, the anti-British rhetoric would go up again. So, there were very, very close financial ties, and indeed, Barings Bank, which was a very important British bank, was one of the main creditors for U.S. bonds during the war. And there were times whenever it seemed as though the two countries, Britain and America, were about to get into some kind of conflict, Barings would remind the U.S. government that it held all these bonds, as it were.
You know, they certainly the other countries in the world beside the British were watching this conflict. You can turn to later history, something like the First World War, for example, where you can see something that starts out as a very local conflict, draws in a number of other nations in a way that somehow seems not to make sense, and yet it happened. And I'm thinking about the title of the book, which I think was actually a reference to something Seward, the Secretary of State, said about the possibility that he would go out and start a war with Britain or somebody else. What was there, do you think, in looking at how other countries looked at this and how various rivalries could become involved, whether the U.S. Civil War did indeed have some potential to become a world conflict?
Absolutely. That's quite right. If say, Britain and America had got dragged into the war, several things would have happened at once. First of all, Britain would have recognized the South, and it would have, because at that point Britain had a huge navy, and the most powerful navy in the world, as did France. France would have done the same thing, since at that point their international diplomacy was hand in hand with each other. They would have both broken the federal blockade of southern ports, and that would have meant that the South could then easily go off and trade with anybody, and would have done so. And the second thing is that probably Russia, which was still upset about the Crimean War, probably would have come in on the side of the North just so it could pick a fight with Britain and France. And it's hard to say what the Germans were going to do. Bismarck was unifying Germany and certainly was looking for a way to destabilize British and French influence in Europe. So maybe they would have come in on the side of the North. Maybe not. But yes, I can definitely see a world war starting, and so that a conflict that was literally thousands of miles away could have set the whole world on fire.
Yeah. Another caller here, and Posodum, line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Very interesting. I'll make this quick. I'm just curious, did any Brits come over and fight on either side? And if there was, were there any military people?
That's a great question. I'm glad the caller raised it. Unfortunately, we're almost at the end, but I'm glad the caller raised it because that is a big part of your story.
Yes, you know, it's a huge part. Funnily enough, although, I mean, yes, international politics does play a big part, the bulk of this book, A World on Fire, is about these individual volunteers who came over, literally left London, got on a boat, sailed over, and volunteered. And some volunteered for the North and some volunteered for the South. And, for example, Colonel Fitzroy de Courcy who later became Lord Kinsale, was the colonel of the 16th Ohio Volunteers. In Illinois, the Chicago Conspiracy of 1864, where Illinois Copperheads, Confederate Southerners, conspirators, banded together just in the summer of 1864 in the hope that they could mount a coup, kill the governor, take over the legislature, and free the Confederate prisoners in and around Illinois that were in federal prison camps, were led by two men, one of whom was an English volunteer called Colonel George Grenfell. So they were all over the place. And it's just funny. It's like Woody Allen's movie Zelig, but wherever there's an important American event, there's always either a British volunteer or a British observer recording it. And so it's been absolutely fascinating and such fun looking at these British doctors and nurses and spies and agents and officers who became involved in the war and, you know, and fought each other. And at one point, we have two British officers who were, one joined the North, one joined the South. They had both been fought together in Garibaldi's campaign in Sicily, and they literally bumped into each other on the battlefield. And the recorder's saying, "Percy, old boy, what are you doing here?"
Well, and this is a real, and now we've given people a reason to go out and buy the book and read it, to read some of these great stories. But it's certainly true that there are those stories, and some people that went on to become quite, that who we know fought in the American Civil War. And I guess one person who sort of stands out in my mind is Henry Morton Stanley, who went on to be a journalist. He worked for the New York Herald, and this was the guy they sent to Africa to look for David Livingstone. He was the guy who said famously, apparently he said it, or it's said to have said it, Dr. Livingstone, I presume. Henry Morton Stanley fought for the South in the U.S. Civil War.
He did, but then he deserted and joined an Illinois regiment, and then deserted after 6 weeks, disappeared for a year, came back and joined the U.S. Navy, and was on the USS Minnesota at the fall of Fort Fisher in January 1865. And then he deserted again and reappeared as the correspondent for the New York Herald.
And I guess it's not unheard of that not only were there British people who fought in the war, but actually fought at one time or another, fought for both sides.
Well, I think Henry Morton Stanley definitely takes the prize for being a serial deserter. And then ironically, while he was fighting for the South and deserting, Dr. David Livingstone's own son ran away from home and joined the northern side and died in a southern prison as a prisoner of war in Salisbury camp.
Well, we're at the point, I'm sorry to say, that we're going to have to stop. And I do, again, want to make the point that while we spend a lot of our time talking about geopolitics here, and that's an interesting big part of the story, the people part of the story is also quite interesting. And because, indeed, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, tens of thousands of British citizens came to the United States and fought in this war on both sides. And many of the stories are in the book. So if you'd like to read more, the book is A World on Fire: Britain's Crucial Role in the American Civil War, and it's published here in the United States by Random House by our guest Amanda Foreman. And Ms. Foreman, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Many of our past shows, along with local news features, are available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue, so please stay tuned.
As you make your year-end giving decisions, please consider a gift to WILL. Listener support is the heart and soul of this station, and your gift will help pay for the programs you rely on next year. Make a tax-deductible contribution online now at willpledge.org or mail a check to UIF/Friends of WILL, 300 North Goodwin, Urbana, Illinois, 61801. Thank you. Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 95 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets as we roll into mid-session on the next to last day of trading for the year of 2011. This morning, the Energy Information Administration released its latest status report for U.S. petroleum stocks. The numbers look like this. Crude oil is up 3.9 million barrels over a week ago. Gasoline is down 700,000 barrels from last week. And ethanol remains at last week's level, and that is 17.7 million barrels. As we look at June crude oil futures, we see that they are down today slightly after opening the day today at $100.05. They're currently trading at $99.08 on the day. Meanwhile, as we look at cash basis for grains, we We see that corn and soybean spot bases are steady to lower at elevators and processes around the U.S. today. As farmer sales are increasing as we approach the end of the year, as well as the futures values rising on the board. Some dealers are noting an increase in grave movement and a pickup in new farmer sales. Corn bids are slipped about 2 to 4 cents per bushel at processors, and soybean bushel